Hey, loyal listeners, this is Tim Gray from the Gray Area of Comedy. And I'm here on Showbiz Monkeys podcast, kind of a, it's close to a podcast.
Yeah, Paul Little, I'm here too.
Woo, Paul Little.
I'm of the Paul Little comedy.
Paul Little of comedy.
Yeah.
Oh boy.
Yeah, we are covering the Just for Laughs festival right now.
Yes, we are.
And, got lots and lots and lots of interviews lined up.
Yep.
This next one you're about to hear is with beatboxer turned sort of comedian.
Yeah.
Beardy Man.
He is hilarious.
He is. He's very hilarious.
A huge fan.
As you will hear, he has a lot to say. Very interesting fellow. Has an interesting career path to get to comedy from beatboxing.
Keeping it real.
So yeah, enjoy.
Showbiz Monkeys interviews Beardy Man.
Yes. Here we go.
Hello. My name is Beardy Man, and you're listening to Showbiz Monkeys.
Showbiz.com.
Around this town, I'm alright. Around this town, I'm alright.
I mean, no consequence when you're playing with the back.
For those who are unfamiliar with your history, can you kind of explain how you first got started doing beatboxing and eventually to the point where it was your career?
So I always made noises all my life and started doing beatbox at university. Even though I'd been doing it all my life really, but I didn't know that it was something that you get praised for. I always thought it was something that people would tell you to stop because it was annoying, which is generally what had happened. And then bit by bit, people started to sort of acknowledge what I was doing, and I started to get gigs first off the back of kind of comedy shows, actually. I was doing this improvised comedy show with a bunch of friends, and that grew into, you know, one sketch where I had to beatbox in the sketch grew into a career. Just I started getting gigs doing beatbox. I really didn't think it was ever going to take me anywhere because I just didn't think there was a place in hip hop for me. But what I didn't realize at the time is that you didn't have to do hip hop to do beatbox. You know, and I sort of carved out my own niche based on my skill set and my preferences.
Well, I find it interesting actually hearing that you were doing comedy even before your beatboxing, because now you've kind of started doing comedy festivals and stuff with your beatboxing.
Yeah. Well, you know, it was kind of, you know, it wasn't stand up or anything. It was improvised comedy shows.
Yeah, yeah.
So kind of like, you know, theatrical comedy improvising, that kind of thing. But I didn't even really do it that much. You know, I was always like amongst the goofier of my friends and always sort of doing stuff like that. And I was always involved in sort of drama and stuff whenever I could. You know, and I'd always done music and I'd always written songs, and somehow whenever there was like an instrument somewhere, I'd end up kind of learning to play it. Or if there was like an opportunity for there to be like a gathering and music involved, I'd somehow always end up being involved. And like, you know, any time I did something where there was a bunch of people who were bored and there was like a piano or a guitar or something, I'd always end up being the kind of like the entertainer. Everyone would end up singing along and just playing songs at people's requests and stuff like that. So I suppose those are my kind of earliest influences, you know, like basically it's just entertaining people just impromptu, just based on whatever people suggested, just because I've always been able to play things by ear. So that was all, you know, and I'd, in my free time, I'd always just sit around learning songs on the piano or on the guitar. And so I always had like a big lexicon of things I could draw on. But, you know, I'd always end up like writing songs and stuff that were kind of pertinent to wherever I was. And so, you know, if I went on like summer camps or, you know, anywhere I was, like in offices or anything, I'd always be making up satirical songs and things like this. So I suppose I've always done it all the way through my life and in some other form. And, you know, beatbox was just another opportunity to kind of, you know, show off and sort of do stuff. And I just find it really therapeutic to do music. But I mean, you know, now it's my career. Now there's a bit more direction to it. So it's kind of, you know, making sure, I mean, for me, it's making sure that whilst I'm having fun, I'm also making sure that I keep keep things accessible for the size of audience that I'm doing, which is an interesting one because, you know, if you go out and do something on a massive stage, which I now do quite often, especially this summer in England, I'm doing, you know, playing to like crowds of like anything from 8 to 30,000 people. Yeah, I mean, the challenge there, well, at least it used to be a challenge. I think now I'm having, you know, experimented with how far you can push things in terms of comedy or music in any given setting. I think I now know how to balance it all perfectly, but I think, you know, it's been a challenge in the past to try and perfectly balance the comedic with the musical or with the hardcore, you know, because like I like to try and do everything that I can in a set. I like to try and, you know, regardless of what the audience is, I like to try and push the envelope as much as possible. Because, uh-huh. You know, when I'm watching something, you know, my mind's always racing of all the different options that, you know, where could it go? Or you know, like I'll get bored very easily. And so I think it's just a route for ADD.
Yeah.
Really. And so it's trying to rein that in, but still kind of keep that element to it. Cause it'd be very easy to go onto a massive stage and just play your heart out. But you know, I mean, I don't know, for a while it was a challenge. Like for a while, like for the last kind of year or so, or before this year, I don't know, the thing that was on my mind was how to go out onto a stage and keep the kind of silly comedic element when there's a huge amount of pressure and there's a massive crowd and they want to dance. You know, how much comedy can I squeeze in? But I mean, I think I now know, and the answer is very little, but it's just about choosing when you drop the comedic things and making sure that those comedic things are a particular kind of comedic thing where it's not like you being all modest and self-effacing and dropping a joke about your mother-in-law or something. Like you can be stupid and goofy and very loud and very pronounced ways which suit that environment. But when you're in a smaller environment and you're doing like a comedy gig, then you can really kind of the crowd's a lot more forgiving, or they're a lot more attentive. So in a way they're less forgiving because they're hanging on your every word. So those words better be good, but right. You can also, you know, if you're comfortable with exploring things and you're comfortable with knowing that if something fails, then that can be funny. Then it's not that scary a prospect, just kind of venturing into the unknown. So it's actually a lot more fun. So it's weird that I kind of do these two parallel careers, which are kind of tied together. But, you know, most of the bookings that I get are, you know, in the kind of musical vein of, you know, I'm the other people on the bill are big bands and big DJs, and that's who I'm competing with. You know, these people with these huge followings who've had at least one big album out or at least one big tune that they know they can end with, and they're a DJ. And then there's me. And, you know, I just released my album, and it's not even out in all countries yet. And it's quite a silly, fatuous kind of affair with lots of kind of genre pastiches on it and impressions of rappers and singers and stupid sketches. And it's a bit goofy, and I don't think anything on it's going to chart. And that was kind of a deliberate decision. It was a deliberate decision, really, because I wanted to do something that was kind of my own. And I didn't want to do something that I thought would make it into any kind of mainstream circles. I just wanted to do something that was going to be ear catching and stand out, but be as goofy as I wanted it to be, but as, you know, make some really tight beats. Cause I'm just, you know, I'm into electronic music, and I'm into futuristic sounds and kind of, I'm into production and, you know, the art of production as a form of music, you know, but there's also this kind of comedic side. But I mean, you know, it's funny because I know from minute to minute, you know, what I want to do or what I want to be will kind of shift, you know, right. You can see that happening throughout a gig as well, where like, you know, because I appreciate so many different kinds of music. I know I'm not unique in this. Like these days, you know, you look at anyone's iPod, and with a few rare exceptions, everyone is very open-minded when it comes to their music taste.
Right,
and
right.
everyone's got guilty pleasures on their iPod that they don't really want anyone to see. And everyone's got, you know, the odd kind of really extreme form of music that they listen to when they're in an extreme kind of mood. And everyone's got, you know, music, which is a lot more chilled out. So everyone's got these sort of crazy duplicitous sides to themselves. But I mean, hopefully what I can do is bring people together around this kind of central totem of me. But yeah, the actual music that I do or whatever kind of performance I'm giving will kind of be sort of really varied. So mm-hmm. I think it all does tie together in a weird kind of way. It's just, you know, the art of trying to do the right thing for the right kind of crowd. But often doing the right kind of thing for the right kind of crowd will, for me anyway, will consist of doing the absolute most wrong thing possible, but doing it in the right way, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah. Well, as long as you can keep them on board with what you're doing.
Exactly. Like, if you take them on the best kind of journey, or you know, if you just could have, if, I mean, you know, you could instantly switch up from, like, some big ballad into like the craziest dance music ever, but you just need to do it at the point where the dance, where the ballad has become boring.
Yeah.
And then you just go, ah, fuck it, and then just go dance music, and everyone will go, yeah, and that's what they'll really want. And whether they're into dance music or not, they'll love it, because there's a huge raise in energy, and they'll go away from that being like, wow, I really like dance music, I didn't realize I did. But with the Just for Last thing, it's going to be much more of a kind of comedy show. So whereas, like, most of my bookings tend to be on that kind of side of my career, where it's to festivals or like, you know, my own gigs or whatever it is, but they're standing up and they're drunk and they're dancing and they want to see each other. Now it's like people who are sitting down and wanting to be entertained and are a captive audience, and they're hinging on your every word. And so it's kind of, it's a different game that you play, and it's more about exploration and sort of just kind of, you know, delivering things in a different way and being much more relaxed, and you don't have to be so hyped, and, you know, there's a place for getting hyped and stuff, but it's a different kind of being hyped. It's kind of more kind of a mental alertness about being sort of self-aware and kind of comic timing, not in a musical sense necessarily, but more in kind of, in a more general sense, just responding to what the seated audience would be thinking, basically. Like, if I start going into some sort of musical thing, then if I feel it's gone on too long, then I just stop it and draw attention to the fact that it's gone on too long, and that can be the thing which is funny. And that's good, because it's kind of, I mean, people laugh at all kinds of different things. You know, people laugh at things they don't expect. They laugh at things which they do expect. They laugh at arrogance, they laugh at modesty, they laugh at failure, they laugh at self-awareness, they laugh at lack of self-awareness. It's weird. It's like, it's almost like people want to laugh together at things that they notice, if they think that everyone else has noticed as well. It's like it's just a way that people have a bonding with each other, I think.
Now, is that what you were just talking about there, of like recognizing what people find funny? Is that something you just develop by, you know, being out there and doing those big shows? Because normally people in the comedy world, they start off really small, do a bunch of small, you know, open mic gigs, stuff like that, and build their way up. But you kind of were thrown into doing these bigger comedy shows after not having done much comedy.
Yeah, and it was terrifying, because I mean, I've done the odd stand-up show here and there, but generally what I was doing at those was taking things that I'd learned and routines that I'd worked out from corporate gigs that I'd done. And, you know, I'm being completely honest here. That's, you know, as much as I've always wanted to do comedy, I did not have that much experience at it at all. Like, apart from slipping sort of large chunks of comedy into what I do.
Yeah, yeah.
Like when I've done beatbox gigs and making people laugh and seeing what works and knowing that I can trust my kind of comedic sense, because if I think I'm going to find something funny and I do it, then generally I think other people are as well. They at least laugh that I'm doing something stupid. But like, then there's, you know, specific things that I was doing for these corporate events where I'm doing beatbox, but everyone's sitting down. So I'd keep referencing the fact that it was ridiculous what I was doing. And sort of, so a lot of the material that I sort of developed there, where it's just basically just me being kind of very apologetic and self-aware about what I'm doing and ridiculing the idea of beatbox, that kind of, you know, there's a comedy that comes from that. But, you know, since then, and since doing JFL last year, and since having done lots of, like 2 years of Edinburgh shows in bigger and bigger venues, I think three years of Edinburgh shows in bigger and bigger venues. There's, I think I've gained in confidence over what I can put into my sets, and you know, the sort of stand up bits have got longer, and yeah, you know, any comedian who's playing, like, you know, that when they have big ticketed shows in like arenas or something, they'll make surprise visits in comedy clubs, or they'll do secret shows just to test out material. I'm doing a similar thing at the moment, just kind of doing small scale gigs just to kind of, you know, explore things, see what works. And it was terrifying being thrown in at the deep end when I went to JFO last year, having had some experience but not anywhere near enough, I don't think, and then just kind of being thrown in there. And there's Tim Minchin, who is a big hero of mine, Jimmy Carr, who's a complete legend, and I think is amazing, and is also really famous, and me, some fucking beatboxer from the UK, amongst the cream of British comedy. I shat myself. I've never been so scared in all my life. It was terrifying. But afterwards, I suppose it's a bit like spiders, you know, like afterwards they all told me that they were more scared of me than I was of them, you know, because, you know, here's some little punk coming along with something different. And so, you know, anytime I'm on like a comedy bill, I'll go and do something, and then a comedian will come on afterwards, and they'll have to kind of try and take me down a notch, because that's what they do. They're funny men, so they have to try and ridicule me in a way. So it's always funny seeing what they say when they come on after me. Like, they're always like, well, that's just cheating, isn't it? Like, I could just play raspberry and go, how do you like that? You know, that's generally what I get. But, like, yeah, God, it was fucking terrifying. I don't mind telling you. I was fucking petrified. But, you know, I did my best, and my best seems to have been all right.
Are you excited to go back to Montreal specifically this year?
Well, Montreal's weird because it's quite divided in terms of the communities. It's two completely distinct communities living in the same city. It's very odd. And there are two comedy festivals, and you don't get people going to both comedy festivals. It's very strange. I mean, like, you know, you look at the French program, and it's very different to the English program. The English program's lots of headshots of comedians trying to look like the man and looking very serious, and sometimes they're a tiny bit goofy. The French ones are these nutters in costume with all these paper mache heads and objects and people in lycra suits doing mime, and it's just a very different kind of festival. I'm excited to come back because it is fun. It's a nice place. I actually like it. I really like the vibe.
You've done quite a lot of touring all over the world. Have you noticed a significant difference between audiences in the UK, North America, and elsewhere?
Yeah, well, I don't know. I mean, there's differences. I mean, American audiences are, I think, a lot easier to get excited. They're not quite as cynical. English audiences are generally made up of English people, and English people are a cynical bunch. So it's not that they're harder to laugh. It's just that, like, it's a slightly different kind of vibe. References, I think, are the problem between English and American audiences. It's like, you know, you can't make jokes about cutesy English things in America without making reference to them specifically and kind of explaining what they are. But there's an advantage in that, because if you're looking at someone's country from an outsider's perspective, then sometimes you can say things about them which they might not have noticed, or which people from that country would feel like arseholes saying. If you're from another country, I mean, there's a guy called Reginald D. Hunter. I think he's bigger in the UK than he is in America. He lives in the UK. And a lot of his comedy is based on just taking the piss out of us completely. You know, just commenting on what we're like to be British. And we love it. It's like being tickled. We're like, yeah, we're such dickheads. We're so up our own asses. We're so cynical. We're so closed in and fucking boring. So you're so right. We suck. So, like, you know, I mean, maybe that works in England more than America, because America's quite proud, or it was anyway, when it was any good. But, like, you know, it's fun.
I saw you a couple weeks ago on Conan. That was actually my first introduction to you. I was curious, did your work with Reggie Watts help you land that spot, since he's so connected to the show?
It may well have done, yeah, I think so. I mean, yeah, I think so. I mean, I actually met the booker from Conan when I was doing Montreal. So it wasn't a direct hookup from Reggie, but I'm I'm sure that kind of hurt, because I mean, we're not so different, me and Reggie. Like, there are more different acts out there. You know, he's a looper and a beatboxer, does music and comedy, and you know, he has a bigger afro, and and he's a complete genius. And I respect him hugely. And we have worked together in the past, and I'd hope to work with him again as well. But the Conan shows can be a bit mad, so I think the kind of thing that me and Reggie both do, although it is different, I mean, I'm sure whatever it has in common, I'm sure suits the Conan experience.
How was the experience of performing for American TV for the first time?
Pretty scary. It was a big deal. I actually wasn't happy with what I did at all. I think I actually sort of was a bit too relaxed, and I just kind of deliberately took it in my stride because I thought that would be a nice thing to do. But I think, to be honest, it would have been better to, I don't know. I mean, there's always a million ways you can approach things, and there's a million different things I could have done. Like, before it went out, like, I was, we were toying with the idea of, well, shall I just do like a song from my album, or shall I do like just a set with a microphone, or shall I do like shall I do something I've written especially for the show, or shall I take a suggestion from someone, which is what I did. But even taking a suggestion from someone, there's a million different ways I could have done that, and there's a million different ways it could have gone, and like, so I don't know. I think personally, that wasn't my personal best.
Well, yeah, I found it interesting just from an observer's perspective, because I've spoken to some stand-ups who have done Conan and other shows like that, and they talk about how very specific every joke has to be. Like, they go over it with the staff of the show for months to say, okay, this is what my set's going to be. And I'm guessing with you, it was more that you were given a lot more freedom to go wherever you wanted to go.
Well, that took a lot of wrestling. Like, I had to, you know, I really wanted to make it all up on the spot, because I just thought that was how I'd get the best thing possible for the spot. And I wanted to do something that was as distinct from Reggie, because I know that he's a staple of the show, and I didn't want people to be like, oh, well, here's some English guy doing a similar thing. Like, I wanted to do something that was fairly distinct. I mean, I'm never going to completely get away from the comparisons, but like, I mean, you know, this is something I do a lot. This is where I take like a suggestion and just kind of make it happen. But like, yeah, no, that took a lot of convincing. Like, they didn't want to do it. They wanted me to write something specifically for it, and they were trying to sort of direct what it was I was going to do. And in the end, they just gave up. And they actually gave up at the point where I was willing to give up and do what they wanted as well. So we both kind of were standing there going, oh, well, I don't mind. I was like, well, I don't mind. And they're like, well, So then I just went ahead and just did whatever. And it was kind of, it was a bit strange, but I think it was good. I don't know.
I certainly enjoyed it.
Cool. Well, I didn't realize that girl from Bridesmaids said Ladyfingers.
Yeah.
And in England, you say Ladyfingers, and I think of okra, which is what they call them in Indian restaurants. They call okra Ladyfingers. But I don't think people have that in America. So I ended up doing a song about okra and ladyfingers, but apparently okra is eaten down in the South. So that kind of made sense with me doing bluegrass, which I was doing. and ladyfingers, it turns out, are a snack anyway, or they're like the base of a tiramisu. So
yeah.
So like, I was talking about eating ladyfingers, it kind of worked. So luckily it kind of, it could have been a lot worse. But like, just about what?
Yeah, I didn't even realize that you were referring to something completely different than what I was hearing.
I know, it was just a really lucky thing. I just said okra in passing, and I think people were so kind of astonished at this weird skinny Englishman standing before them on their TV that I don't think they heard the word okra. I think it just went straight past 2 million people's heads.
Showbizmonkeys.com.